May it please the court. This attorney discipline case consists of two unrelated counts. Count one alleges that the respondent violated Rule 8.4C and 8.4D, that's dishonesty and conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice, by asserting legal authority she did not have when she entered a locked motel room, held an innocent woman at gunpoint, then searched and seized the contents of the woman's purse. That night, the respondent was assisting her friend, a bondswoman, in the attempted capture of a fugitive who was not then present at the motel, as everyone knew at the time the respondent searched the woman's purse. As to that count, the respondent denies that her behavior violated any rules. The hearing panel partially accepted that analysis, that she was merely following the orders of a local police chief, but also found that she exceeded that authority by continuing to search and seize after it was clear that the fugitive was not in the room or in the motel. In fact, that theory, based on a claim that she was authorized to back up the chief as a member of an appointed posse, was, in our view, fully contradicted by the chief's and Ms. Sanders' own explanations when they described the events in their police reports, and hers also was called a supplemental report, but also in their testimony in the motion to suppress, which was filed by the woman who was charged by drugs that the respondent found during her search of the woman's purse, and then a small pouch within that purse. Count two alleges, and respondent essentially admits, that she repeatedly violated Rule 1.15 by commingling client funds with her own when she routinely failed to place unearned fees, not yet earned fees, and fines to be paid to the court, traffic fines to be paid for the court, and costs to be paid to be forwarded to the court, and that she kept inadequate records of her trust account, and that at 8.1 violation for failing to produce the trust accounting records. My concern with the posse defense has several points. First is that respondents' explanation for even being with the bondswoman was this. Miss Cox, she said, the bondswoman, was not very big, and that they only called the police because the law required it, which is true. They did. That is, the law did require them to notify the local police when they go to make an arrest or capture of a fugitive. Also, the police report and the testimony at the initial hearing was the motion to suppress hearing, was that the chief was only there to assist us. And in fact, there was no mention in the statement or in that early testimony that the chief requested any backup. She said he assisted us, not vice versa. The chief agreed with that and said he did not deputize him. The term posse didn't come up, but the term whether you deputize somebody did come up, and he said he did not do that.
Did he say he had asked her to have his back? Or?
Yes, he did. He said that he asked her to have his back as they entered the motel room. The police report and the testimony. Remember, this is by an attorney who practiced criminal defense law for 10 years and has been a police officer for 10 years. Made no mention that she asked for consent to search the purse or the contents of it. She did not mention that was material until she was charged with a crime and charged by our office.
And can you explain to me a little more what was the misdemeanor that she pled to? What was the conduct that was addressed by that?
What's it called? Yes, thank you.
I'm sorry?
Peace disturbance by a loud noise. That was the charge.
And what was it based on? What conduct was it based on?
Well, probably yelling in the motel room. I mean, they were screaming to she and the police chief were both saying, get your hands up, to the woman that they broke in on.
And so that was a misdemeanor?
That was a misdemeanor. That's the only charge that was finalized.
But right. Who did the police chief charge her, or there were other police who came, or do we, I should ask opposing counsel.
I'm sorry, did the police chief charge who?
The
respondent? No.
Did he arrest her for the misdemeanor, or were there other police who came because of what was going on, or
no,
how did this
occur? There's no evidence that at the time that the parties, the police chief or the respondent or the bondswoman, thought they might be charged with a crime. It didn't come until much later.
Okay.
The insurance division regulates bondswomen and bondsmen, and they looked at it, and in fact, Ms. Cox, the bondswoman, was required to pay a fine for allowing the respondent to assist in the attempted capture.
Thank you.
Respondent said that it was her independent judgment to conduct the search of the purse, and that the chief did nothing and said nothing. Respondent's brief has a portion where there's a suggestion that the chief asked this for a respondent to conduct the search. I couldn't find that anywhere in the record. And the respondent said it was her own independent judgment to do that. The respondent admitted that she was not looking for weapons or for a phone when she conducted the search of the pouch within the purse, but that she did expect to find the drugs that she did indeed find and then turned over to the police chief. And then, you know, the other thing that I think is material is her bragging on Facebook before this incident about going on fugitive hunts with the same bondswoman, saying, you know, I'm taking my two guns, my baton, my handcuffs, and my pepper mace. And her testimony after all this, when the insurance division got involved and we got involved, was that it did fundamentally change. But she said that initial statements, those initial statements were truthful. But she said at the time she was attempting to support the prosecution and the police. So we think the dishonest masquerade as somebody with authority, whether it was as an assistant bonds person or whether it was somebody that had some authority to hold somebody at bay at gunpoint and take somebody's property and then search it and see what's there. We think that is a violation of 8.4 C and D, and that the sanction should be at least a state suspension. She admitted that she was in police mentality during the event. Ms. Cox, the bondswoman, said the respondent was acting like a police officer. The court may remember the Dade case from 2013. It's SC 92970. In that case, the lawyer, Missouri lawyer, went to Kansas, used his sister's Kansas bar license to get in to try to practice law in Kansas. So it's the same kind of thing, the masquerading with authority as if you have authority that you don't actually have. And in that case, we had actually concurred or accepted the panel's recommendation for a reprimand, but the court required, it may have been a reprimand with requirements. In any event, the court imposed an order of state suspension with probation. The commingling count also, and you know where it would fit if it were standing alone, you just probably heard that argument. It's not that much different than what these other cases that you know might end up being less. That one of the key differences is that there is an admonition in this case. It was in 2012. It didn't have anything to do with trust accounting. It was just a communication and diligence. But in 2012, the respondent had two overdrafts. We ended up finding no misconduct, but we did issue letters of caution, and with those letters of caution said, take this CLE class, read these materials like the how-to book that the Missouri Lawyer Trust Fund Foundation puts together, and also read Formal Opinion 128 and Rule 1.15 that says if it's not your money, then it has to be in the trust account. And that includes fees not yet earned, but more importantly, probably, money that's never going to be yours, like the fines and the court costs that clients hand over to lawyers to make sure their fines and court costs get paid. I'll be back. Thank you.
I'm surprised to hear Mr. Phillips say that he doesn't know where this came from when my client testified that she was asked to look in the wallet of Ms. Oakham, who was the lady that was with the fleeing suspect. I've cited it to you at the appendix 162, 177, 211, 248, and 249, all of which are in the brief.
Did the chief say that, or was the chief asked that?
No, the chief did not appear at this hearing. We've never had a chance to cross-examine the chief. We'd love to have that opportunity. But, I mean, the chief's testimony at the preliminary hearing and at the motion to suppress for Ms. Oakham was pretty much back and forth, and as Mr. Phillips admits in his brief. This case, from our standpoint, she is a person who has been requested, directed by the chief of police to aid in the apprehension of this fugitive for whom there is a felony warrant. And their versions of what occurred go back and forth. The chief says, I was in charge out there and I was responsible for serving this warrant and I'm going to serve it, as if he doesn't need backup for a man who's supposed to be carrying a pistol and be dangerous. The testimony of my client and Ms. Cox is that the chief said, I can't get any backup. He asked if she was armed. She said she had a pistol in her vehicle. And he knew that she was a former police officer. And he said, you're going to be my backup. And she protested and said, no, I don't want to do that. Well, the question is she acting at his request? And if so, what's her authority? The bigger question, I think, is when does that authority end? I think it's very clear that she's covered by the posse comitatus rule, even though they want to claim that it doesn't apply to a municipal officer, which the chief was.
Even if it applies, just for the moment, once they found out the fugitive was not there and he didn't need backup for his safety, what was her continued authority?
Well, she is still there at his direction to watch his back and make sure he doesn't get shot in the back, as he says. What happens is that Ms. Cox is talking to Ms. Oakham, trying to find out, where's the number that we can get a hold of Tommy Darnell, the fugitive? And she says, it's in my phone. I don't remember, but it's in my phone. And then she says, the phone is in my purse, and she reaches for the purse. Well, nobody has looked in this purse yet to know whether there's a weapon in it. We know that Darnell is supposed to be armed. We don't know whether this lady is armed or not. She's an experienced police officer. She knows you don't let somebody who particularly has been acting somewhat erratic reach into something that you haven't seen. And so at that point, she says, just a minute, I'll look in there. And Ms. Oakham says, whatever. Makes no protest about her looking. So she gets the purse, She dumps it out, and there is one phone in there. No weapon at that point. These things are on the bed. At some point, the chief says to Miss Oakham, "What's your name?" Miss Oakham refuses to tell him. The chief says to my client, "Get her ID out of the wallet." She is obviously doing just what he's told her to do, still within the course and scope of doing what she's been tasked to do by the chief. That's still within the posse comitatus rule. So I think Mr. Phillips is correct that if she's entitled to the posse comitatus rule, there is no violation of those things having to deal with the claim that she did something by misrepresenting herself. She didn't misrepresent herself. She told the chief who she was. He knew she was a lawyer. He knew she was a former police officer. There isn't any question. And the thought that a municipal police officer can't bring somebody in as a posse comitatus to assist them, you don't have to deputize them. You just have to say, "I need your aid and assistance." And you're, quite frankly, bound to do that if you're requested to do it. This court, way back in 1901, and I love to cite those cases that antedate my birth, said that a constable is entitled to ask for aid and assistance, and you're bound to give it, and that you're then covered with the same rights that the constable is, which is to make a felony arrest at that point.
Do you really think the Attorney General's office would have brought charges against her if she said no?
I'm sorry, Judge, you couldn't hear.
Do you really believe the Attorney General's office would have brought charges against your client if she said, "No, I'm not participating in this"?
They brought the charges, and she told them that.
No, do you think they would have charged her with not participating in this posse if she refused to cooperate with this police officer?
I would hope not, but who knows? The case, the initial case, the Evans case, I say the 01 case, says that those who are called to aid or assist are bound to assist.
And do you think we would be sitting here today if she had refused, even if she had been charged?
I don't know about if she had been charged, because I think they've gone a little overboard on this anyway. But no, my guess would be if she'd have said, "No, I'm not doing any of this," probably not. Also, but it was her understanding from her time in Texas, and of course Texas is different than Missouri, but that she didn't have a right to refuse. She took that seriously.
So why'd they charge her with a misdemeanor?
Well, this made the circuit and eventually got to the Attorney General's office. And at the Attorney General's office level, they had her charged with kidnapping and had the felony of being involved, participating in fugitive recovery, a number of other felonies. And I think, quite frankly, what happened was when they learned of her defense, that they said, "We're not going to get this done." And so they dismissed the felony cases and said, "If you'll plead to peace disturbance, we'll be done." Peace disturbance is not a crime of moral turpitude. It's not a crime for which, under the rule, any further type of discipline would be in play. And so she said, "Fine, I'll do that." So it was a bargained deal.
Sure. How should we be affected by her texts or emails earlier talking about how much fun it was to go out there and with these handcuffs? First of all,
it's not charged conduct that she did something.
But how does that affect your credibility on these other things?
I don't think it credits. She explained it. This This was more a joke than anything, because she did not have with her any of the things that she was talking about. And they asked Miss Cock, with whom she was, she didn't see any of them. So it was an ill thought out attempt at humor after she went on this other venture to California. She didn't do anything on that one. There was no gun mall type of thing that went on. But back to the posse comitatus thing, they say with posse comitatus does not apply because this was a city police officer. Well, a constable is a city police officer way back in 01. And in 51, the right to call for assistance is not limited to sheriffs. It's applicable to municipal officers, and that's State versus Johnson that this court decided. The State versus Parker case says that any person called to assist an officer is acting as posse comitatus, clothed with the same protection of law as the officer, and you are bound to assist an officer and to aid him. So I think it's clear she was bound to do so. Had she decided not to, might have been the better course of action, but as a police officer, she probably takes orders better than in some other situations. She's used to that. Back to the question of when was she authorized to do something, it's amazing that 9 days after this occurred, the chief calls her at her law office in Springfield, and he doesn't claim that he's got any cards or anything from her. He thinks she's a bondsman. Simply not true. He called her, and he said, "I want you to make a supplemental report." Now, there's a lot of significance to a supplemental report. Who can make a supplemental police report? A policeman, someone acting as a policeman. A witness gives a statement, and the chief was even asked about that at the suppression hearing for Ms. Oakham by Ms. Oakham's attorney, and he agreed that it would not normally be a police report if it was a just plain citizen doing it. I want to touch one thing here. I don't have a lot of time left, and Mr. Phillips indicates that the recommendation today is for a stay suspension. The disciplinary hearing panel recommended a reprimand with conditions, and those conditions were some that were suggested by Ms. Dillon from the OCDC that might be helpful. Her trust account situation is she runs a traffic office along with a criminal office. She gets $95 to handle a traffic case. When she gets $95, or at least until this came up, she figures she's already earned it. She's met with people, whatever it is, done the entered appearance, sent stuff to the prosecutor, entering to the court. So she was putting those in her operating account, bypassing the trust account. They say that's commingling. Well, that's pretty questionable. When is a $95 fee earned? If you make $300 an hour, charge $300 an hour.
Well, if you get one check and you put it all in your office account as opposed to the trust account,
if you earned it and
you took the fine money, right? Isn't that what the allegation is? It's not
clearly, Judge. In those cases where she got fine money,
right,
those should clearly have gone into the trust account, and she understands that now. Mm-hmm. The overdraft that she had was, again, this wonderful modern law office technology, where she's got high volume traffic practice, people using credit cards, and the way the overdraft came up was they push the wrong button, and instead of depositing the check to the creditor, the office account, it go or to the trust account, it goes the other way, and it's a deduction, and that creates an overdraft. She has had no prior discipline problems. But the one thing I do want to say is the OCDC signed on, as we did, to the discipline of a reprimand with conditions. And I was just noticing that they even filed a proposed order with this court, which said, respondent is hereby reprimanded. That was back in December of 2016. There's been nothing happened since that time to today with my client. She's done nothing. She hasn't been involved in any problems, and no reason to suspect that anything should be greater than a reprimand with conditions. And we would agree that she's happy to have conditions and deal with Ms. Dillon anything that would be helpful. She had a previous bookkeeper who was fine and had no problems. That lady retired. She hired another bookkeeper who changed her system. Then she had problems. She's now gotten rid of that woman and got the original bookkeeper back. So she's back in good shape. There are no client funds missing here. But I'm bothered by the fact that the OCDC accepts the findings and recommendation of the panel. And they say to this court, and they say to me, we want you to sign an order that says reprimand. And they start to brief this case, and that's the first time I learned that they're now asking for a suspension stayed with probation. I did not brief anything in regard to what other possible disciplines there might be, because I felt that I was bound by what I had accepted, which was that I could argue for a reprimand with conditions. I didn't think I could argue for anything else. Had I known that we were going to have this situation, I'd be saying, give her a probation, a straight probation, and let's don't deal with this any further. She didn't do anything wrong with the classe comitatus, and she's protected by it. And our position is we ought to go back to the original agreement when we accepted the disciplinary hearing panel's final findings of a reprimand with conditions. Otherwise, if we're going to be faced in this disciplinary process with acceptance of something and then a change, this thing isn't going to work very well. It'll be very difficult for people to rely on what is happening, and I don't think that's good for the system. That we ought to say where we are and stay where we are when we do those things. Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor.
We don't think the posse theory applies because of the facts. I think the only way that applies is if the court decides that it doesn't believe the respondent in her first statement, her supplemental report, police report, or doesn't believe her initial testimony when all the facts are contrary to what would be a posse theory. We think that sometimes we accept panel decisions after we have argued for something that is, in this case, for instance, we actually asked for an actual suspension at the hearing, and the panel came back with this recommendation. Sometimes the interest of judicial economy, we think it probably is important if the panel comes back with something less than what we asked for, we should at least do some double check in our own mind. Did we ask for too much? I mean, we don't always accept just because they do, but we at least have to look at that. And sometimes there's probably a range that's acceptable. In this case, you know, we were invited. The court probably recalls that after the and this was not a stipulation, it was an acceptance of a recommendation. But after that came out, the court asked us to show cause as to why a state suspension would not be appropriate. And I could not, we could not show cause. I mean, a state suspension is appropriate. So that's how we got here, and I'm comfortable with that position we've taken. Thank you.
Thank you.